This is Endrican Feedback Loop. I am your host, Chase Hendrickson, and welcome you to this Journal Club podcast series brought to you by the Endrican Society. Thanks for joining us as we explore an important article recently published in one of the Society's clinical journals. Hello and welcome back to Endrican Feedback Loop for our 46th episode. Today, we look at a recent paper from the JCENM that attempts to understand why we see a limited effect of bariatric surgery in individuals with type 2 diabetes. With all of the attention these days on medical therapy for obesity, we thought it would be helpful to discuss the effects of surgical therapy for obesity so as not to forget about an important weapon in our armamentarium. As is typical for us on this podcast, we will review an observational study today, and we'll try to carefully think through the intrinsic limitations that come with these investigations. As is usually the case on the Endocrine Feedback Loop podcast, two excellent endocrinologists join me today for this discussion. As a brief reminder before I introduce them, I host this podcast and work at the Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Tennessee, where I see patients as a general endocrinologist and work as a medical director. With us for the first time is our regular contributor, Na Shin. She comes to us from the University of California, Los Angeles, where she is an expert in obesity medicine. She runs the program for reducing obesity in their ambulatory clinic and conducts quality improvement in obesity management. Our guest expert today also joins us from California. Ken Fujioka is at the Scripps Clinic, where he directs nutrition and metabolic research and obesity telemedicine. He is known to many of you for his extensive work in clinical trials in obesity, as well as his many publications in the field. So, as is usual for us, the perfect pair of endocrinologists joins me to help us understand this research. As is also always the case, everything we discuss will be our opinions only and not necessarily those of our respective institutions or the Endocrine Society. For this month's episode of the podcast, we review limited bariatric surgery-induced weight loss in subjects with type 2 diabetes, predictor variables in adipose tissue. The Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism published this article in November 2023 with Oscar Osorio-Conley from the Instituto de Salud Carlos III in Spain as the first author, and several other authors from institutions in Spain joining him. At this point, I will turn things over to Na. She will walk us through the author's introduction and highlight the key points that they make. She will also get Ken to help us understand some key aspects of obesity medicine along the way. Na?
Thank you, Chase. So in the introduction, the authors start by stating that bariatric surgery is the most effective approach to sustained weight loss. Now, Ken, do you think this paradigm will continue with the advent of more effective medical therapies that we have today?
As we stand as of today, which we have a couple of really potent GLP-1 receptor analogs, one which is actually GIP as well, bariatric surgery still beats them out. And it's interesting that you see the exact same thing that they saw in the study, that you get less weight loss in the type 2 diabetic versus the non-diabetic for any surgical option. It's the same thing with actually the GLP-1 receptor analogs. You see about 5 to 7% less weight loss. So even though in the obesity studies, you see this phenomenal 20% weight loss, which again is just to me outstanding. Mm-hmm. If you look at the diabetic studies, which they've used the obesity doses in diabetics, you see weight loss of 10 to 15%. So later on, we'll cover what some of the other studies have shown, but the weight loss is less. It's anywhere from 5 to 10% less every time. So again, as of today, maybe the future might be different.
And many studies have shown type 2 diabetes to be an independent pre-surgical predictor of reduced weight loss post-bariatric surgery at short, mid, and long-term follow-up. However, mechanisms for this aren't really clear. Ken, can you kind of discuss some of these proposed mechanisms for this?
Sure. Many years ago when I was a fellow, this was actually a debated point whether there really was a difference. And again, these are kind of the dark ages when all we had was metformin and sulfonylurea and insulin. And most of us thought, well, it's probably the medications that are keeping them from losing weight, because as many of you know, sulfonylureas and particularly insulin, you can really drive up weight if you're not careful. With that said, with this paper and other papers to come out, it's real clear that this is a different group of people. They just have different genetics. Something is different. And the mechanism could be something as simple as, it's just really bad insulin resistance, Or maybe it's something systemic that's being directed by the hypothalamus that's directing things. Or in this paper, they're arguing that no, it's at the level of the fat cells. Or again, we used to think maybe it's the level of the lean tissue. Any one of those can be a potential. It's kind of a lot of moving parts, and any one of them could be the cause.
So changes in morphology and functionality of adipose tissue have been associated with weight loss variability following bariatric surgeries. And very few studies have looked at the association of these features and limit to weight loss in type 2 diabetes patients following bariatric surgery. So there were two aims to this study. The first one is gaining further insight on the association between type 2 diabetes prior to bariatric surgery and weight loss outcomes at short and midterm follow-up after bariatric surgery. And the second aim is evaluating the potential association between adipose tissue biology and weight loss outcomes at short-term follow-up in subjects with or without type 2 diabetes undergoing bariatric surgery. I will give it back to you, Chase, to discuss the methods.
Good. No, thank you. And Ken as well for giving us a nice overview there of what we know, but also importantly, what we still don't understand. Ken just described it as for years, we've been asking this question of why do we see this in type 2 diabetes? We see it consistently, but why is that? So we're going to think about that a little bit more. So as we think about the methods here, we'll do what we normally do. This is an observational study, and so we want to think about the study design and how that impacts the findings that the authors come up with. And I would describe this, as the authors do, as a retrospective cohort study. As a reminder of how retrospective cohort studies work, first of all, cohort studies, those work by having a group of subjects, that's your cohort, and then within that cohort, you have to be able to subdivide those individuals into multiple groups, at least two, sometimes more than that. And that is based on the presence or absence of an exposure. Frequently, we think about exposure as a medication or perhaps something in the environment, but that doesn't have to be the case. As we'll see here, exposure can be something that is a clinical feature for these individuals that are being followed in this study. So that's what we're going to see here, and that's what splits people into an exposed group versus a non-exposed group. Importantly, something that is just a baked-in limitation of observational studies is that they are not randomized. In clinical trials, so Ken has done many of these and could go on at length about how these work, but one of the many strengths of a clinical trial is that you randomize people. So you are not choosing who gets an exposure, who does not get an exposure, and that helps limit many, many problems, and including being able to know exactly what is driving this and biases that might be associated with this. But in observational studies, you don't have that. So there is people choosing to, should you have a weight loss surgery? Should you not have a weight loss surgery? Obviously, no one here is deciding on the exposure because that's a clinical feature, whether somebody has type 2 diabetes. But what we are not going to know as we get into this is the fact that somebody has diabetes or does not have diabetes. Is that driving whether or not they are even recommended and encouraged to have weight loss in this? So something that we have to keep in mind, the authors have to deal with it. It always comes with observational studies. So we'll think about how the authors deal with those limitations. Okay, now into this study. And the authors actually have several different groups. They describe having two separate cohorts in addition to what they have labeled as a control group. I might use different terminology around that, but we'll think about that. So first of all, the main cohort, or as the authors describe it, cohort number one. And these are subjects who underwent either a Roux-en-Y gastric bypass or gastric sleeve as the primary bariatric surgery between January of 2005 or December of 2014. And they were able to subdivide those based on the exposure that we talked about. So they had individuals who also had diabetes at baseline, 543 participants, and then a larger group, more than twice as many, who did not have diabetes. That was 1,116. So that's cohort number one. Cohort number two, those are individuals who underwent bariatric surgery, but in addition, they agreed to have a biopsy, and that was either of the subcutaneous adipose tissue or the visceral adipose tissue. So they did biopsies at both sites here. And this was done in 2018, and this was individuals, again, with type 2 diabetes, so there were 48 individuals, or they also matched 48 individuals who did not have type 2 diabetes. And I think an important thing to think about here, particularly as we consider invasive investigations that are volunteer, is that we do have to worry about the possibility of a volunteer bias. And as a reminder of what that is that when you have individuals who agree to do these sorts of things, who agree to do biopsies so that we can better understand this, is that the folks who tend to volunteer for these sorts of studies are maybe not always representative of the population at large. And so there may be some limited applicability of these findings to an entire population. So not necessarily, but something we will keep in mind. And finally, the third group that was studied here, this is what the authors describe as a control group. I wouldn't think of it as typically when we think of control groups, that again, back to clinical trials, we're often thinking of somebody who receives an intervention and somebody who does not receive an intervention, and that group that didn't get the intervention was the control group. This was really just taking a group of individuals who had neither obesity nor type 2 diabetes and wanting to understand that quantitative mRNA, the genetic study. And so that was really what this is just to give another normal comparison, if you will. So we're going to think about these groups as we go along. Okay, so this study, we'll think about, first of all, as far as criteria to be included in this. So the inclusion criteria, they use standard eligibility criteria for bariatric surgery per their institutional guidelines. And they considered you to have diabetes if you met one of multiple criteria. So it could be traditional diagnostic testing. So if you had a glucose of 126 or greater, that is fasting, or an A1C that's 6.5% or higher, or if you were taking any medicines for diabetes. That in their review got you in the type 2 diabetes category.
Chase, if I can bring up one point, just so you know, there has actually been a change in the bariatric surgical guidelines. In the old days, it was a BMI of 35 or higher with diabetes, you could get bariatric surgery. Believe it or not, and it's actually getting covered by a couple of insurances in California now, if their BMI is 30 or higher with type 2 diabetes, they may approve bariatric surgery. And I never thought I'd see this day where they would lower to that level. But in Asia, they've been doing this for quite a while, Japan, China, Korea, because weight gain is so poorly tolerated by the Asian population. So they've shifted everything down. And they do mention that in their current guidelines, but these just came out. And again, I was shocked to find out that a couple of insurances actually covered at that low.
Yeah, and Ken raises an important point here. It's helpful to understand exactly what got you into this study, because as we think about how do we apply this to our patients, recognizing that the landscape of clinical care changes regularly, and so we have to be mindful of the data that we're reviewing and trying to apply that to our group as this gets older, and particularly with looking back at patients that were enrolled nearly 20 years ago. Okay, so the exclusion criteria for that first cohort. So if the authors were unable to determine based on the available data whether or not you had type 2 diabetes, so you were not included here. And then a final one, we're going to get Ken's input on this, is that you were excluded is if you had to undergo revisional surgery at some point throughout the study period. So Ken, give us an understanding that this is something that often the surgeons are dealing with, but what is the trigger for maybe needing to have a revisional surgery? And then the authors report how often they had to exclude folks for that. So what is your sense on this based on this population of patients?
Why did they do the revision? What was it? Probably there's a couple of things that will do that. Like if somebody had one of the old adjustable bands, a mechanical device that they begin to fail after a while, they'll take it out and they'll convert them to either a sleeve or a bypass. So that's one type of revisional. Another one is if they get the sleeve, so all you're doing is just, you know, making the stomach smaller and trying to remove that section of the stomach that makes ghrelin, and they will lose weight from that. But a common side effect is reflux. So they'll get reflux and it gets so severe that they got to convert them to a bypass. And then the final reason, which unfortunately may affect the numbers that we're seeing in the study, is, and it's pretty common, inadequate weight loss. And they call it, I think, IWL, insufficient weight loss. But this is a problem. And you know, as much as 15, 20% of patients who get bariatric surgery just don't lose much. And so you convert them to the most aggressive procedure, which happens to be the bypass. Their population is fairly similar to ours, 80% women, a BMI of, you know, 42, 44, age 46, you know, again, everything's kind of right where I'm used to seeing it. But again, this, you know, you're bringing up this revisional surgery thing. It is a little different from what I'm used to seeing.
And then as far as exclusion criteria for cohort number two, because specifically the authors were doing biopsies here and they wanted to understand tissue changes, a few more exclusion criteria. So you could not be included if you had a history of malignancy, any chronic inflammatory disease, if you had an active infection, any drug abuse, or relatively high alcohol consumption. And as we've talked about before, but to be explicit on it, as far as the exposure, so this was the presence of a pre-surgical diagnosis of type 2 diabetes. And then the outcome that we're looking at, a couple of different ones, the main one here is the association between having type 2 diabetes and their short and midterm weight loss after bariatric surgery. And that's using weight loss expressed as a percentage of the total body weight loss, and that's relative to the baseline. And finally, the other thing that they're looking at is differences in adipose tissue parameters. And that, again, is comparing individuals with type 2 and without type 2 diabetes in that matched study, that second cohort that they have. And that's done by performing an RNA analysis, looking at expression with a 60-gene panel. As far as confounders go, and again, this is something that's important to consider in non-randomized studies. So observational studies like this, folks did not end up in one group versus another based on random allocation. So we need to look at confounders because they are often not balanced here. And the authors looked at this in a couple different ways. So several of them, they measured them and used them to adjust their findings. And another one that they did is that they used several to do a sensitivity analysis. So that is not where you're automatically adjusting, but you are looking to see if you had adjusted or if you had included or not included a certain confounder, would it have affected the results that you came up with? And if you find that it doesn't affect it, then it's okay to include it as is. So there's a couple different approaches that they used here. So what they measured was age, sex, baseline BMI, the type of surgery, and insulin use. Later on, this is actually in the discussion where the authors bring this up, is they mention a couple of things that they were not able to measure. So they did not have access to either diet or exercise. And so unmeasured confounders are always of concern because that could have an impact here. And it's common. Sometimes we just don't have access to that information. Sometimes there's things that are not ever thought about at all. So Ken, as you look at that list, anything else that you can think of or not for that matter that maybe should have been included as a means of a confounder?
Personally, I always loved to see the number of patients that were removed because of inadequate weight loss, and I couldn't really find it in there. I was hoping they'd have some kind of table that would show me this. That would have been one very helpful thing, only because when you have a lot of patients that are removed for inadequate weight loss or because they had to do a surgery or something like that, you are skewing the results towards patients having better weight loss because you're taking out patients that didn't lose as much.
And with that, I'm going to hand things back over to Na. That's an overview of the methodology that the investigators use here, and she will walk us through the results that the authors found. Na?
So when we look at Table 1, the patient characteristics, in Cohort 1, we're seeing predominantly female group at 73.1%. The mean age of Cohort 1 was also about 44.9 years old, plus or minus 11.2 years. The mean pre-surgical BMI was about 46.7 plus or minus 6.4 kilograms per meter squared. And out of this cohort, about 32.7% of these subjects had type 2 diabetes. And they also had higher prevalence of hypertension, statin therapy use, fasting triglyceride levels, and gastric sleeve as their method of bariatric surgery. So this is interesting to discuss whether this cohort is similar to our patient population, Chase and Ken.
Very similar to ours. Typically what we see in our, and we're a referral center, probably just like this place is. So 70% women is pretty common, and a lot of places actually 80%. And then the age 45, yeah, right on the money, 46 for us. Mm-hmm. BMI, they actually have a pretty good size BMI, 46.7. That's getting up there. I think ours is a couple of units lower. And again, we're getting referrals and we're getting tough cases. And then 32%, 32.7 up for diabetes. That's just a hair higher, although whether they had diabetes and we didn't know it, or in other words, it was just diagnosed, they probably would not have included them in our group, but their numbers are right on.
Same. And then looking at cohort 2, we definitely have an older group. Their mean age was 53.1 years in the non-type 2 diabetes, and 54.1 years in the type 2 diabetes patients. Cohort 2's BMI was up, mean BMI was also lower compared to cohort 1. They had an average BMI of 44 in the non-type 2 diabetes group, and 43.3 BMI in the type 2 diabetes group. There was also a gradual loss to follow-up over time in cohort 1. However, the study does not define the breakdown in which groups this occurred. At year 5 follow-up, data was assessed in about 73.6% or 1,143 out of the baseline 1,552 patients. And in cohort 1, the percent total body weight loss at 1 year follow-up was about 35 plus or minus 8.4% in the non-type 2 diabetes group versus 30.6 plus or minus 8.9% in the type 2 diabetes group. And then the percent total body weight loss at 5-year follow-up was 28 0.9 plus or minus 10.6% in the non-type 2 diabetes group versus 24.6 plus or minus 9.8% in the type 2 diabetes group. And when they used multivariate regression analysis, adjusted for potential confounders, which included age, sex, baseline BMI, and type of surgery, they found that type 2 diabetes was independently associated with lesser weight loss in cohort 1. And at year 1, the beta was negative 2.7. Year 2, beta was higher, negative 2.96. Year 3, beta was negative 2.95, and so on. Year 4, beta negative 2, and you know, at year 5, beta was still negative 2.19. So in the type 2 diabetes group, A1C, insulin treatment, and number of anti-diabetic medications at baseline were associated with lesser weight loss. However, there was no association with duration of type 2 diabetes prior to surgery. Ken, do you have any comments on this finding?
I do. So Chase mentioned earlier that, you know, your gold standard study is a randomized trial. And so there actually is a randomized trial, believe it or not, for bariatric surgery versus medical therapy. It's a little bit older trial. It's about, I think it's at least 6-7 years old by Schauer and colleagues, called the STAMPEDE trial. And they took type 2 diabetics, they randomized them to either medical treatment or to surgical. And their weight loss was much less than this group. So they saw 22% weight loss at 5 years and 18.5 for the sleeve at 5 years. So relative to these numbers, that's less. And I'm impressed with their weight loss. And again, my guess is that some of the patients that had insufficient weight loss got removed because they had surgery to switch them over from a sleeve to a bypass. So that's the first thing I see. And again, you won't see studies like this very often, but a randomized controlled trial to surgery or not, that's pretty rare. But again, Schauer pulled it off, I think in 2017 or something like that. And they find what we typically see in that, you know, typically the more insulin your patient is on or the more diabetic drugs they're on, and by more, you know, roughly three. Once you get over three or more medications, you typically do see less weight loss, which they kind of see and kind of don't see, which I find interesting. So you can use that as a predictor that they may not have as much weight loss as opposed to, say, somebody who's just had diabetes for a year, they're only on metformin, and they're going to really act like a different kind of patient. And again, they don't see this, but longer duration, a lot of meds. Yeah, these patients really struggle with weight loss.
And when they used logistical regression analysis in cohort 1, the type 2 diabetes group compared to the non-type 2 diabetes group showed a 95% higher probability of insufficient weight loss, defined as less than 20% total body weight loss at 1 year follow-up, and 57% higher probability for insufficient weight loss at the 5 year follow-up. And then moving forward, when they looked at the cohort 2 findings, both groups, interestingly, showed similar mean adipocyte fat cell distribution and degree of histological fibrosis in the subcutaneous adipose tissue. However, in the visceral adipose tissue, both groups show similar tissue fibrosis in mean adipocyte cells. However, there was a higher proportion of larger visceral adipose tissue adipocytes was present in the type 2 diabetes group. So then if you look at table 2, showing the gene expression analysis of 60 selected gene panel, in the subcutaneous adipose tissue type 2 diabetes subjects, coagulation factor 13 chain, F13A1, as well as autophagy-related genes ATG5, ATG7, and ATG12 were all upregulated, while the sterile regulatory element binding protein 1, SRB1, was downregulated. In the visceral adipose tissue type 2 diabetes subjects, fatty acid synthase, or FSAN, and uncoupling protein 1, UCP1, were all downregulated. So, Ken, what do you think of these findings?
You know, in all honesty, this is way above my pay grade, but I have looked at some of these. So essentially, you have mitochondria, and you can actually turn them on just to burn energy. If you have a background in biochemistry, it's technically called futile cycling. You may remember that from your first year in med school. Anyway, and they'll just burn energy, and it's great. And we've actually, over the years, have looked at different ways of trying to turn on UCP, because it's kind of like exercise in a bottle. So that really makes sense that they saw that in the visceral adiposity. And again, I'm one of these old school guys that says, you know what, diabetics, their visceral adiposity is what bothers me. The subcutaneous, not as much as an issue. With that said, they looked at 60 selected genes. That's a lot of things to look at. And to me, that kind of does lower your power a little bit in terms of, okay, is the finding real or are you just on what we call a fishing expedition? But with that said, they did find differences and that, you know, certain proteins are downregulated in the subcutaneous tissue of type 2 diabetics. So, but I struggle with putting my head around some of these proteins and how are they doing it other than UCP, which has been studied many times by other people as well. And it's real clear. Yeah, that's downregulated. They just don't have the ability to burn as many calories.
Yeah, no, that's a great point you make, Ken. And, you know, after looking at the 60 genes, they did find that ATG5, ATG7, and ATG12 were associated inversely with short-term percent total body weight loss after bariatric surgery. And only ATG7 was significantly associated with weight loss at the 4, 8, and 12 months follow-up time point, which increased after adjusting for confounding variables. And when they did a hierarchical linear regression analysis to assess the contribution of ATG7 expression to the prediction of percent total body weight loss at 1 year following bariatric surgery, they showed this by looking at three models. Model one, they found that ATG7 expression in subcutaneous adipose tissue explained 5.5% variability. However, model two, when they looked at clinical variables, which included age, sex, baseline BMI, type 2 diabetes, and type of surgery, they found that this explained about 13% of variability. And then in model three, they looked at ATG7 expression in subcutaneous adipose tissue plus clinical variables, and this accounted for 24.8% of the variability. So Ken, what are your thoughts on the impact of ATG7 explaining 5.5% of the variability compared to the impact of clinical variables?
You know, I actually struggle with this, mainly because I don't know these proteins that well, but more along the lines of, I think you can ask just about any expert in what makes a diabetic a type 2 diabetic, and insulin resistance will always be up there, but also visceral adiposity, which is just such a big part of it. So the fact that they found this really in peripheral fat, I struggled to wrap my head around this one saying, okay, this is the answer. With that said, it is nice to know any predictor that would tell us, okay, which one might predict lesser weight loss, because then let's say you have somebody who just became a diabetic and so they're determined, I got to do something about my weight, and they're just on metformin and their A1C is pretty decent, but they have a BMI of over 40 and they say, yeah, I got to do something about this, or even over 35. And so, because at that point I could say, well, you could do a sleeve or you could do a bypass, but now I'm going to really lean, if I have this information, towards a bypass to get that extra 5%. Because in general, the bypass will give you about 5% more total weight loss than the sleeve under almost any circumstance, or whether it's a diabetic or non-diabetic. So it is helpful information. Whether I would use it and get an insurance to pay for it, it would be tough. But you know, this is a start. It's starting to move us in the right direction to say, hey, we got some predictors. And again, we're always looking for predictors. I mean, it's sad because the kind of predictors of what gives you better weight loss are, unfortunately, things like depression, believe it or not, sleep apnea, binge eating disorder. So those are predictors that we know about. And again, I like this age, sex, baseline BMI, obviously type 2 diabetes and type of surgery, 13%. But then when you add this in, you get, you know, 25%. I'll take that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I mean, that's a great point. And when you look at figure two, it shows ATG expression in subcutaneous adipose tissue were found to be highest in type 2 diabetes subjects with obesity compared to non-type 2 diabetes subjects with obesity. So they're definitely finding something that could be a new predictor, anything to help us glean more information. All right, I'll turn it back to you, Chase.
Right, now, thank you. So we're going to think about now how the authors put together all these results. Now, through them, there's a lot of data here, so we'll see how they synthesize that and what we think about that. So a couple of summary statements that the authors make. So the first one is that our study confirms previous findings of limited midterm weight loss response to bariatric surgery in subjects with type 2 diabetes independently from other covariables. And then the second comment is that the subcutaneous adipose tissue expression of ATG7 was found increased increase in type 2 diabetes subjects with obesity and associated to the amount of percent total body weight loss 1 year after bariatric surgery. And the authors then go on to discuss things a little bit further, and specifically as regards type 2 diabetes as that independent risk factor for limited weight loss following bariatric surgery. They point out that this study supports other findings in the past, as well as that higher A1C levels are inversely associated with weight loss outcomes. So Ken, you commented on this a little bit already as we've gone along the way, but help us understand. So knowing this is just more data, we thought we had a good grasp of this already. This study really confirms what we thought already. How do you actually use this information? Or for those of us who are listening to this and trying to think about this, when you counsel individuals with type 2 diabetes, do you factor in the fact that they may not lose as much weight as if they didn't have diabetes? Or just how do you communicate that to your patients?
So this is an interesting point here that actually Tom Wadden and colleagues showed years ago, that you can counsel patients on how much they're going to lose. And it doesn't matter whether they're diabetic or not diabetics. They're going to say, I want to lose 30% of my weight. I want to be what I weighed in high school or college or something like that. And that's a lot of weight loss, 30%. And it doesn't matter whether it's a medical trial, whether it's a surgical trial. That's what they really think in their head. But they'll take 15%. The minute they get over 15%, they are happy as all get up. And hence why you can't get a GLP-1 if you want to the pharmacy, because they're already out of supplies, which is crazy. So the way we counsel them, knowing that, and again, you can tell them all you want, they still think they're going to be in that group. So we give them a range. And so somebody's going to get the sleeve, whether they're diabetic or non-diabetic, I'll say, okay, you probably lose between 20 and 25% of their weight. They'll go, what does that mean? And then I'll write down some numbers for them and calculate it out for them. And knowing that the 20% is closer to what a diabetic will lose, and then the 25 is closer to what a non-diabetic will lose. And again, remember that this study is just showing you average weight loss. So there are patients who do better, and you never want to dash a patient's hopes. I hate to say it, it's like cancer, but you want to keep them hopeful and keep them on track. And then the same thing with the bypass, I'll tell them, you know, between 25 and 30%. Again, knowing though, they're going to be closer to that 25 or maybe even a little bit less than that if they're a diabetic. And again, one of the greatest studies of all time by Wadden and colleagues, that how patients are just so tracked in, no matter what you tell them, they think they're going to be that 30% weight loser.
And then as far as the effects of the specifics around the adipose tissue, the authors summarized their findings as saying that they found a positive association between the A1C levels and the visceral adipose tissue adipocyte area and the subcutaneous adipose tissue fibrosis. And they conclude that there is an importance here of the adipose tissue histologic features as determinants of metabolic disease, despite the fact that the weight loss and the histology associated with that was not seen in a propensity score matched cohort that they looked at. And Ken's given us some of his thoughts on this already, is that we still need more information. There's more to come, but we'll circle back to this in a second. But it's at least pointing us in the right direction of, hey, maybe we're understanding this a little bit more, and maybe in the future can turn this into information that we can use. So we will come back to that. But the authors go on to speculate, based on that, is that it is possible that subcutaneous adipose tissue overexpression of ATG7 in type 2 diabetes patients at baseline might have restrained fat mass loss after surgery in their cohort. And that's how they're describing a potential mechanism here. The authors point out several limitations that they have. We've talked about some of them already. They remind us that this is not a randomized study, so the possibility for residual confounding is definitely there. They point out that in that second cohort where they did the gene analysis, there was a limited number of subjects in it, certainly compared to cohort number one. They point out that there's at least a possibility for suboptimal histologic evaluation. And with the gene testing, that the assessment for that ATG7, the one that they found the difference in, it was limited. So it was only looked at baseline, and so they can't comment on whether there might have been dynamic changes after a surgery occurred. And then finally, something we've talked about already is that the behavioral aspects rather than adipose tissue biology features in type 2 diabetes subjects may explain lesser weight loss in this group. And again, that's potentially tied to exercise and diet information that we don't have. The authors conclude by summarizing their work as, the present study highlights the importance of type 2 diabetes as predictor of limited weight loss following bariatric surgery. And then finally, what I would describe as an implication, as the authors describe it, is that our data suggests that altered gene expression of genes involved in the core machinery of macroautophagy may contribute to such limited response. So we're going to come back to those specifics here in a second. But I wanted us to think about, as a group, just the quality of this report overall. Nah, let's start with you. What are your thoughts, just the quality of this report as a whole?
It was a good, very ambitious study. They really try to look at multiple aspects of this issue that we're finding. But again, because it's retrospective and a lot of what we touched on already with the limited histological samples and volunteer bias, I think, you know, we have to be careful when interpreting these results. But I think overall it was very ambitious and they really try to tackle multiple aspects of something that we see a lot in real life.
Ken, any additional thoughts on the quality of the report overall?
I like it. Nah made the same points that I would make. A couple of things that to me are take home though. It's real clear that once you start getting large visceral adipocytes, you're going to get into problems, whether it's metabolic syndrome, early heart disease, or diabetes. Anyone knows, and they saw that. And again, having done some of these biopsy studies, and you mentioned this earlier, these patients are troopers, you know, they're going for it. And they give us just a great wealth of information, which they show. And again, cements the idea that there's something different about the adipocytes of the type 2 diabetic. And then just really cements the idea that type 2 diabetic patients just lose less weight, no matter what you do, medical, and again, the most aggressive surgical. How does that apply to me and other bariatric surgical centers? Pretty much most sites are really recommending gastric bypass because of the more weight loss, but also because of the improvement in type 2 diabetes is what we're seeing at most sites. So the surgeons will really lean towards that. It's good and it's bad because they get more weight loss. The surgeons like that. The patients like that. But what happens is then we get the patients maybe 3 or 4 years later when they're getting hypoglycemia because they were really a very early stage type 2 diabetic or maybe a pre-diabetic, but they did a bypass and now they're getting these low blood sugars, hypoglycemia, which is always tough to deal with. One of the harder things I know of, but again, ends up back with the endocrinologist.
But Ken, let's stay with you here as we think about this. So you've already given us an overview of how this information builds on what we've known already about the type 2 diabetes limiting weight loss and how that then affects what we might recommend, that we actually might say, hey, you need the more aggressive surgery because we've already got a built-in limitation. But as we think about how this could change our practice, it's early days yet. We've got more information that needs to come out, more studies that need to happen. But is it possible that we're moving in a direction of personalized care to where this sort of information is actually something that we go looking at? Or is there a future for us in years to come to where we're actually doing some sort of gene expression or a biopsy to understand, are you somebody who's going to have such limited or such great weight loss based on gene expression that that's actually going to help me decide whether you should have that? Just we're speculating here, obviously, but what are your thoughts about the future? And is this a direction that we might be heading in?
I think you're right. I think that we'll be looking for anything that helps us predict so that we can avoid some of the downfalls of bypass, because it's a great surgery. It really improves type 2 diabetics. So for the diabetic, it's still, to me, number one. With that said, you get an early type 2 diabetic, you may not want to subject them to the nutritional issues that come up, the dumping syndrome, the hypoglycemia, all the things that they can get. You just don't want to go down that road, especially as we're doing younger and younger patients. I mean, these patients were not that old. You know, we're all the time doing patients in their 30s now. That's just common, and the 20s. So any kind of little predictor that we could get there. And then you're looking at how much is left of that pancreas. You know, as many of you know, you've lost much of your pancreas by the time you're diagnosed as a type 2 diabetic. But if you're getting them early on, yeah, I might want to just do a sleeve, knowing that I can add on a GLP-1 or one of these newer. And again, the newer stuff coming down the line, it may actually compete with bariatric surgery in the type 2 diabetic. But as of today, I would say, nope, bariatric surgery is king. But again, as you know, we have some phenomenal agents coming down the line.
And with that, I would like to thank Nah Shin and Ken Fujioka for joining me for this month's edition of Endocrine Feedback Loop. I hope that you all learned as much as I did today and that you will join us again next month. And now you're in the loop. This has been Endocrine Feedback Loop. Endocrine Feedback Loop is brought to you as a members-only benefit of the Endocrine Society, with production oversight by Brandy Brown and Andrew Harmon. We would love to hear your feedback on this episode or the podcast itself. Please email us at podcast@endocrine.org.